Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready for more propaganda? Well, you're in the wrong place at the right time. Columbo Chronicles is for critical thinkers. Let's welcome the consumer advocate for justice. Here's the Rose, Rose Columbo.
Hi, everyone. It's the Rose, Rose Columbo, right here for you.
The Justice Club is back on Columbo Chronicles live podcast. Join Rose Columbo at noon and find out what tips she will provide in a world of little justice.
That's right. There is very little justice today.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. Listen up, because today we have a beautiful day outside on the West Coast if the sun will just pop out of the sky. But we're waiting right here on the good old West Coast, and it's a good old day in the USA. And I hope you're having a great day anywhere you are in the world, whether you're listening online or by phone. But the birds are chirping and we're all here together, and that's all that matters for the moment. We must live in the moment and forget about the past, because there's nothing we can do about that. But we can learn something today, and boy, are we going to learn something today. So welcome to Columbo Chronicles Live. I'm so excited to inform you that I have an exciting and special guest, and he is a well-respected filmmaker, screenwriter, best-selling author, and he's going to share his books, such as his best-selling Walking with the Dead. And he was born in Budapest and came to America, so lucky America, because now he will be on Columbo Chronicles giving us the writers and wannabe writers and writers who are always looking to improve their writing or want to be filmmakers or write movie scripts. And you're in the right place at the right time when we enter into the world of authors and experts. And on part two, when we knock on the door of the Justice Club in search of justice. As a longtime consumer advocate for justice who wrote that popular book, Fight Back Legal Abuse, and watch for the second version coming out, hopefully in 2022. But the interesting thing that I read this morning in the news was that the FBI stopped a plot to assassinate President George W. Bush by Islamic terrorist group. And that is the good news of the day, because whether you like any president or representative of our country or not, in America, we are supposed to be able to agree to disagree and move on and have our own free will and free choice of whoever we want to vote for. If we don't want to vote or we do want to vote, it should be our choice. But thank God President Bush is safe. And that's all that matters. And that's the good news today. It could be any president, and we would feel the same way no matter what. That is just wrong. So I don't know why people don't have other things to do in their life, like get a job. There's plenty of businesses looking for people to work. What happened? So maybe on another show we will discuss that as well. And just to let you know, on part two, we're going to discuss an article that came out in the news this morning. And it is about a billionaire who is being sued for murder. So that should be very interesting and opening up a can of worms that may not ever be able to be closed. It could continue on for years to come, sadly. So we're going to talk about that on part two. But in part one, we will be entering into the world of authors and experts with our dynamic guest. And his name is Charles DeMocus. And that's D-O-M like Mary, O-K-O-S. And at the moment, we're going to take a break. So don't touch that dial, because we will be back in just a moment.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
That's right. Be sure to bring your appetite to the Horseshoe Cafe. And in just a moment, we will be entering into the world of authors and Don't Touch That Dial.
The Justice Club is back on Columbo Chronicles Live Podcast. Join Rose Columbo at noon and find out what tips she will provide in a world of little justice.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
That's right. Listen up, because now we are about to enter into the world of authors and experts. And I did tell you a little bit about our very special best-selling author of Walking with the Dead. And he was also a guest and a featured guest at the LA Book Festival on April 24th to 25th. So we'll ask him about that. And we're going to ask him about many of his different talents that so many of us are interested in, whether it's a current writer, whether it's a best-selling author who needs to improve their skills, or writing skills that can never be improved enough, apparently. And we always find something we wish we would have done differently, right? Or said differently or added. So this is going to be extremely interesting if you are or want to be a filmmaker, a screenwriter, or a best-selling author. So why don't we just get started and let's say hello to our very special guest. Hello, Charles Dalcomos. How are you today?
Yes. Hello. Thank you. Thank you very much, Rose, for having me on your show. This is Charles Dalcomos here, and appreciate being on the air.
Well, we're very happy to have you because myself, I love writing. Been doing poetry since I was a child. And I think a lot of people who write start writing as a child and maybe even extroverts like myself because it takes you away from reality sometimes. So, Charles, why don't you tell us about your background before we get started on your many wonderful projects that you have been successful at?
Oh, well, thank you very much. Well, my background, originally my family is from Budapest, Hungary, where my dad was one of the four conductors. He was a conductor for a number of years at the state opera house in Budapest. And after World War II, I mean, things were kind of rough there, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, from the late 30s, 40s, in through the 50s. And my dad, at one point, received an offer to come out on a concert tour with a singer who was very famous at the time, an Italian singer, Tito Schipa. He was an opera singer from Rome. And he came out to New York, and serendipity, as it would have it, he received a job offer from a music college in St. Louis, Missouri. And so my parents stayed out here, and I got to come join them because I was still living in Budapest with the rest of my family. So that's a little bit of my background, how, we immigrated to the United States and eventually moved to Los Angeles, where my dad had other friends from Budapest, who worked at mostly at Paramount Studios. So that's how we came to Los Angeles.
And, oh, well, thank you, Susan.
Yeah. So
oh,
that's
ahead.
A little bit of my background.
Well, thank you for sharing that, because it's always interesting to the listeners of how people got involved in the media. And Charles, you've written screenplays and directed the Telly Award-winning featured documentary Return to Vietnam. What made you become involved with that film project as a screenwriter and director, because that was an important time in our history?
Yeah, it sure was. Growing up, that was part of my history and the part of many folks in the 60s and 70s, because either one was drafted and sent off to Vietnam, or some of us were fortunate enough that we weren't. I mean, we all had draft information that the government had, and then each year there would be a lottery or, you know, a raffle. And luckily, for me at least, my number was not on the list of folks who were being drafted. And, you know, that always kind of stuck with me, that it's a very hit or miss thing. And I wanted to do something for the folks who did get drafted. At one point, we were friends with people who had been refugees from Vietnam, and they had, you know, pretty amazing stories of surviving the war there. And they introduced us to a group called Vets with a Mission, who at that time were in South Lake Tahoe, who started sending volunteers back, mostly vets, but also doctors and nurses who volunteered to either minister in terms of doing healths and health exams, bringing medicines to people in Vietnam, or by that time, the trip I went on to film was the 10th anniversary. So it was the 10th trip that they had gone back on. And so that's what was the background to Return to Vietnam. And it was a difficult film to make for a number of reasons, but after a long time, I finally was able to finish it on my own. And, you know, it's had a modest success in terms of getting distribution. For a while, it was, I had a TV distributor, and last year I received it back from them. It's now on Amazon Prime, and basically I'm trying to place it with another TV distributor. So, and also to put it out, because Amazon no longer puts out DVDs. So for some folks, it might be of interest as a DVD. So I'm trying to come up with a DVD outlet for it as well.
Oh, that is interesting. So I don't think most people did know that. So tell me, what was it like to be in that country and actually knowing, I think it was about 56,000 young troops that died in Vietnam.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's not just, I mean, a huge number of young people who basically, you know, were just drafted. They were pulled in and said, okay, you go. But it's also, I'm not sure of the total number. I think it was over 5 million people who were drafted. And of those, a huge number were injured. I mean, a much higher proportion were injured than in previous wars, because I guess by the Vietnam War era, you know, the medical resources and ability to bring people back to hospitals was much better than in World War II. So there were also a huge number of people who were injured. And also, as you know, we've seen in different portrayals and read in books, many people did have severe problems adjusting back to civil life. Now, when I first was asked to make the film, started looking into it, we were going to get permission from the government to do it, from the Vietnamese government, but they wanted to censor the film. They wanted to look at all the footage and all this sort of stuff. So we basically snuck along with the medicines, we kind of took small, unobtrusive cameras in there and did it in that kind of a, quote, home movie type style. And the quality by that time, you know, recently has gotten so good that you can use not inexpensive, but the good quality consumer cameras to make documentaries. And certainly I'm not the only one who's done that. In the country, we were tailed. There was a person who, I don't know who he was, but he would sometimes say, okay, you can shoot that way, but don't point over there. That's a security concern or something like that. So they weren't unaware that we were taking some footage. And luckily, we did get the footage out mostly. And then I spent literally some years editing the film back in Los Angeles before it was finished. And it was then shown at film festivals for about a year, which is kind of typically what you do with independent features. In Los Angeles, it was shown at the Sunset 5 Lemney Theater, which is kind of a place for small independent films, at a local film festival, and then subsequently it played abroad. The first place was at the Monaco Film Festival, which was certainly a lot of fun for me. And I went to that one. I didn't go to many of them, but anyway, that was one way to get some information and, you know, get some buzz and feedback. And finally, we did get a distribution outlet for it.
I don't think people really realize that all these American young guys who were eating French fries and hamburgers with their girlfriends and drinking a malt suddenly were told to put on a uniform and carry a gun and shoot people if they had to and face something that was, you know, not normal to human beings to go out and to the battlefields and have to protect your life and your troops' lives and then even shoot people that may have been innocent, but who knows, you know, on the battlefields, who's innocent, who's not innocent. And people don't really realize the post-traumatic distress disorders that these Vietnamese soldiers suffered, not only losing their friends. And in fact, there are high schools who, from the 60s and 70s, who had such a shortage of classmates because they died in the Vietnam War. They were in hospitals, veterans hospitals, and they had to actually combine like 3 years of classes just to get enough people to a reunion from a specific high school. I don't think people even realize that. And that's how many young Americans died or were injured in the Vietnam War. For what purpose, people still ponder. And yeah, also think your documentary is very important for the future, because when you're sending millions of young people on the battlefield and you're going to lose 56,000 or more lives are cut short, people need to know what is the reasoning behind the people in the White House. Don't you think so?
Absolutely. And I had made the film and finished it, as I say, over a course of years, because part of it was coming up with funding. And, you know, that took a while as well to just do the post-production part of it, the putting it together. And after I finished the film and basically got it into distribution, I had somewhat lost track of some of, not the reasons I did the film, but some of the points that you're mentioning in terms of how important getting the story is out. And one reason I came back to it, and I am, you know, trying to get the story out, because the people in this film speak to exactly the points you're making, which, like, one person talks about something which to me is utterly shuddering, which is that he didn't know if he could go back there again, but he forced himself because the areas he was stationed in were what were called pre-fire zones, which meant that basically you could shoot anyone inside and that was okay. And so basically he had to come to terms with facing these Vietnamese people who, you know, before, he was in that situation with. So those are the kind of stories these veterans discuss and set out in the film. And I think it's really important for all of us to hear this and to keep hearing it, and hopefully, that this won't happen again on that level. And I came back to the film partially because, as I mentioned earlier, I received it back from the TV distributor, and I thought, okay, well, it's done. And then last fall, I was on, actually this was through Erwin Zucker, who you know, of course, the book publicist who I worked for in high school, by the way, as my after-school job. He had me on an interview show in a small town near where we are in Florida. The town is called Vero Beach, and we're like 50 miles, 60 miles, something like that, north of there. So I drove down there, and this was for Walking with the Dead. And aside from myself, there were four or five Vietnam vets on the show who were making a pitch for a weekend get-together that they were having to raise money for exactly these purposes, you know, for post-traumatic stress issues and to make people more aware and to come up with money for funding mental health programs. And I thought, well, gee, this is going on. I mean, I may not have been that involved with it in the last few years, but the issue is still with us. And obviously these people think it's important enough that they're doing all this work for it. So the least I can do is to try to make sure the film is out there and try to, you know, reach people as much as I can with it. So that's kind of what got me back into working on it some more. Well, which involves some technical matters, and that's kind of what I'm finishing up doing.
Well, I think that's an important mission because too much of our history is being erased, and too much of the good, they want only the good. Well, there was, but they are wanting to erase things that weren't good, but that all needs to be told so it doesn't happen again, no matter if you liked someone in history or you didn't like them. It's part of American history, and it's just the way it was, and that's what the future generations need to know. And because any country can be invaded, as we're watching Russia and Ukraine right now, and and we have open borders. They don't want to call it an invasion, but when you have 30 million unidentified people coming through your borders and they're still pouring in, that is very concerning, because we don't know their intent. I just read today, and I told the audience this morning, I read that the FBI broke up a Islamic terrorist group who were planning on assassinating the President of the United States. They got into the USA. So here you go. So I think, you know, when we're going to invade other people's borders, or they're, you know, we need to understand what is the purpose of sending our young men and women over to a foreign country and possibly cutting their lives short, and reducing the number of Americans in our own country. And so what about the Vietnamese? Do they know how many actually were killed during that war?
There are different numbers, and no one, I'm sure, actually knows, but the estimate is that I've heard it from a number of different sources that sounds about right, is that for the comparison to approximately over 55,000, under 60,000 American lives that were lost, and as I say, a huge number that does not count, you know, maybe the 500,000 to 700,000 injured. We're talking seriously injured, losing limbs and things like that. Americans who came back but were injured to a point where, they've had severe physical issues, and that's aside from the mental problems. There are approximately a million Vietnamese who they estimate, and this is, you know, Pentagon or people like that, who were killed not just through firefights and personal combat, but through the bombing that happened for approximately 15 years in Vietnam and also the surrounding countries to some degree, Cambodia, Laos, you know, it just went on and on and on. And also in the northern part of the country where there were no American troops, but basically the Air Force was bombing around Hanoi and other major cities. In the film, one of the vets talks when they go visit Hue, which is considered the historical capital. In one firefight in Hue, which is the home of many famous Buddhist shrines, it's the home of the various historical figures, like the one who immolated himself as part of the protest against the war. They estimate in one fight there were 10,000 people who were killed. That's just in one battle called the Battle of Hue. So ultimately, no one knows the exact measure, but the numbers are unfortunately very, very large, and probably a million is a fair number in terms of the Vietnamese who died during this, let's say, 1960 to 1975 period of the war that the United States was involved in.
And I think, too, you know, the did you capture how our troops were mistreated by many Americans when they arrived back home? They weren't cheered like during World War II or
absolutely
other incidents.
Absolutely. And it's not that I captured it. I mean, I have no way of capturing it, but I recorded the soldiers discussing this and crying over it and, you know, kind of venting over it, because they said very specifically, exactly almost word for word what you are saying, that it wasn't like coming back after World War II. And in fact, one says, well, you know, the people from World War II, they couldn't understand it, so we didn't want to talk to them. And then one describes how they came under the San Francisco bridge, the Bay Bridge and the Golden Gate bridges, and they were coming back from their being stationed in Vietnam, and they were on the deck, and they thought, you know, they would get cheers from the people on the deck of the bridges. And then they saw all the signs saying various things, which I can't repeat over the air. And also then people turned buckets of, shall we say, human waste over from the bridge and scattered them over the ships that were coming back. So they said that was the kind of, hello that and welcome that they received, as opposed to the people in World War II who came back as heroes. So I think that had a large part of what caused such a depression. I mean, aside from being physically wounded, what caused such part of a mental depression on the part of many Vietnamese fighters, American Vietnamese soldiers. And by the way, the film also deals not just with Americans. I did not know myself that there were a number of troops from Canada, for example, who went along with the American troops. And so on the trip that I took, there were about five or six of the members who were Canadian former vets, not American, U.S. former vets. So it was not just American, but certainly the film concentrates on that, on the American aspect of it.
Now can you, or do you, can you produce DVDs and sell them or not?
Yes, I have the rights to do that, and it would be probably not worth going into the reasons why I ended up with the rights to the film, because as I say, it started out as a film that I was going to make for the organization, and it ended up being something that became a Pomeranian Pictures film, which is my wife and my small little film company. So yes, I have the rights to do DVDs, and luckily Amazon returned the masters to me. TV company, they said they lost it in their move to some bigger quarters or something like that. So that's I didn't get it from them, but Amazon, which had the DVD rights, they returned it to me. And I'm not sure whether I will be looking for a separate distributor or whether it will be something that I'll just try to do on an interactive basis through our website, which is www.pompixweb.com. Again, it's pompix, P-O-M-P-I-X, web, W-E-B.com, and so that people can purchase it. And my understanding is it's not just our film that Amazon doesn't distribute as a DVD anymore. It's most films. You know, they just now are just doing streaming. And I guess the good news is that they're continuing. They basically gave us an agreement to distribute the streaming version online through Amazon Prime Video, which is, you know, a pretty decent outlet. And so that's at least a start in terms of getting it out there. And I'm looking further into finding another distributor for a TV version. One of the things I've had to do based on Amazon, and I'm just finishing that up, is you need closed captioning now for just about any documentary or feature film on television. And so that's been a challenge in the last 2-3 months, something like that. I've been working on that, and we're finishing it up even as we speak. So once that's done, then I can basically include that as part of the DVD that we will make.
That's fantastic, and I'm so proud of you for doing that, and I commend you for this hard work, because people don't realize how much time, how much effort, how much money it costs to do all of these things, and then to find people with money who are willing to help and help fund these things instead of funding peaceful protests, let's say. So what would you advise listeners who have their own stories in mind, and they want to write, but they haven't, and is it possible for them to write their stories and find a publisher?
Well, it's definitely something that you have to have a passion for. I mean, you really, really want to do it and have to do it. You know, that's kind of really what it comes down to, which means that it's not that you say, well, gee, I've seen this book and, you know, I could do better than that. Well, you probably could, but the fact is, if you come up with a book that's as good as books out there, you will not find a publisher. But if you come up with something that's a little unique, and by unique, I mean that represents your fullest heartfelt desires, background, you know, what you're trying to tell the world, you will come up with a publisher. It may not be Simon and Schuster, like in my case. I think I was turned down by, about a dozen and told, but maybe half of them were publishers, half of them were agents. So roughly about a dozen places where I approached with Walking with the Dead. And this was while I was developing the project at the Santa Barbara Writers Conference over the course of some years. And finally, I did find a publisher, but I did get turned down some. And I think most writers have to be prepared to do that. I mean, you know, there could be an exception, but those exceptions are usually few and far between. So if you have something to say that's uniquely your statement, and you persevere and keep working at it, and by working at it, I mean writing it, rewriting it, showing it to whoever you can show to, friends, other people who've written something, if they're willing to read it, give you feedback, go to conferences, that's what I did. I went to I started going to the Santa Barbara Writers Conference probably around 2011 or 12, and working on different projects, and one of the projects being Walking with the Dead. And little by little, I think you will refine it to a point where you will find a publisher and find an outlet so that you can reach people who will be affected, because that's really what you're trying to do. You're not trying to imitate someone else. You're trying to affect people in a way that will mean something for their lives. And these days, you know, I don't have anything against taking a step to publish it yourself. I think the only reason I didn't do that is because I think that's so much additional work that I don't know that I'd probably still be working on figuring out how to do it. There's more than enough to do if someone else at least is there to help you publish the book, and they do publish it. That'll take some of the load off you, and that'll give you some direction to get it out to the kind of reading audience or viewing audience in the case of a movie that will help the film achieve and help the book achieve what you set out to do.
I think that's excellent advice, and I think that you have to be prepared for all these rejections, sadly. But you know what? I had a very wise man tell me one time, and he said, there's no such word as, I was asking him about a book I had written years ago, and he said, there's no such word as can't.
He goes, I think that is good advice.
You have to keep trying. And then I read another profound statement in D.C. when I was visiting the Lincoln Memorial, and I remember it caught my attention for some reason, and it said, Abraham Lincoln said, we must try, or something to this effect. We must try, for if we don't try, how then shall we succeed? And,
exactly.
You know, or keep trying, because then that, and how many big corporations have failed? I mean, there's so many, and they just picked themselves up and looked at their, okay, I must have done something wrong. Let me reread this, or let me look this over again, you know, and not give up. And they keep trying until they became very successful. So, some people are very successful right away for whatever reasons, but most of us aren't.
I think that's a pretty good summary. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you completely and wholeheartedly. And I think you do have to keep trying, and you have to be open to either being rejected. I mean, it's hard being rejected, but that's part of the process. And many times, I mean, maybe it may have something to do with what you're putting out there, but it may not. I mean, there just may not be the right market for what you envision in that direction, and it just may not be the direction for you.
Or even the timing. The timing could be off.
Or the timing,
for that particular topic.
Yes. Or for that particular company. You know, you just don't know. So, I know it's easy to say that you shouldn't take it personally, because it is hard. It's hard to say, oh, well, gee, thanks. We'll look forward to your next submission, or whatever, polite form of rejection you get. But you just have to either try some other place, or try maybe that, as you say, maybe just the timing was off. And if you try the same outlet in a year, maybe the results will be more positive. Not to mention the fact that, especially these days, I think both at small and large publishing companies, and probably in any business, things change so fast. And the same people who basically said no, if you go back to the same place a year later, might say yes, or there could be new people who've taken over. One little tip on that, by the way, which I've been given, and I don't know if I've really used it, but it's something to keep in the back of my mind, is this is more for media, because in media there are just very few outlets, and You get turned down by most of them. My background in terms of screenwriting seems to always land me where people like my writing, and I've been offered, and that's how I became a ghostwriter for a while. People would say, well, this isn't quite right for us right now, but we have this other project we need some work on. Would you be able to work on that? And then maybe we'll get to yours at some point. So I've been through that two or three times, and so that can happen. But in media, there aren't that many outlets. And in fact,
no.
Quick segue, because Erwin Zucker asked me to mention that Jean Colaccio, my dear wife, who's directed several of our other independent features, and I will be on a panel on June 16th for the Southern California Book Publishers Organization, talking about, quote, the real deal. Real, he said, make sure you spell it R-E-E-L. So hopefully that's what he intended. But I mean, basically, it's about how difficult is it, or what do you do if you do have a book? How difficult is it to turn it into a movie? And it's certainly not easy. I don't want to downplay how difficult it is. But then we'll be talking about that at the next book publicists meeting.
Because almost everybody would like their book turned into a movie. I've been offered, and then it didn't pan out because something happened, not because of the book, because of the something happened with the producer, but personal. And so it didn't pan out. But, I mean, you get that close, and you're like, oh, this is it, you know, and then boom, get sideswiped.
Right.
But you have to just go with the punches, right?
You just go with
the punches. And I just felt honored that he even, you know, called me to his office, you know, I drove up there, you know, and I had read the book. And so I was like, oh, okay. It was very exciting. And so,
well, it is.
It is exciting. And so you meet new people all the time, you know, it's exciting, you know, people have your same interests of the love of writing. I mean, it's tedious. People don't realize how tedious it is, you know, and the eyes, you have to be careful with your eyes, you know, you know, and you have to get up and move around and, you know, not just stay at the computer, because it's not easy to do that and it's not healthy. And so there's lots and lots of things that happen, you know, with writers that people have no clue about. And that's why I think a lot of them start and they give up, because they don't realize that you have to have a passion for it. You have to really love what you're doing. And creating, to me, it's a creation. I get really excited, especially if it's helping people, you know, and I think it's going to help people. And you know, like I tell my daughter, who's very creative and beautiful photography and scenes and art she does, and I'm like, just put it out there. I said, you're always going to have an audience, or you're going to have no, you know, you're going to have people that are negative, and you're going to have people that go, oh, that's nice, you know, and in the middle, neutral. I said, it doesn't matter. There's always a market for you.
Well, I think that's very sound advice. And I think any creative area will have that kind of, I don't know what to call it, but, you know, that's something you have to navigate and get past. But you just can't expect that everyone's going to say, oh, this is the most wonderful thing since Gone with the Wind or whatever. So we'll talk about that on the
16th. Yeah, well, even Gone with the Wind was rejected, right?
Well, yes, and that was, as many books are, that was a huge bestseller at that time. And you know, even those kind of books get into problems. But certainly if you have a small book that is not, you know, on that level, it is very hard to adapt. And there are certain things you can do. Jean's actually, my wife has adapted, since you mentioned poetry, she adapted Robert Frost's Death of the Hired Man into a fairly successful film. And so that one worked out, but that one wasn't easy. And, you know, we've tried a couple of other ones which haven't worked out, you know, kind of learned something along the way. But there is a whole process to adapting books into film. And so we'll talk about that on the 16th with Irwin and the other folks from the Book Publishers Organization.
Yes, and that's on Zoom, so anybody can join in on
correct.
Zoom from the public to the Book Publishers of Southern California.
Right.
And
yes.
they can Google and they can call and find out,
yes.
Google and find out about it as well. And so June 16th, and I think it's 6 o'clock p.m., if I'm not mistaken, West Coast time.
You know, I think you're right. I'm not positive because he hasn't shared that with me, but I think that's the usual time for the get-togethers. And
yes,
in a way,
and the public's invited.
Yes, yes, they are. And I missed the ones that he used to have or, you know, hopefully will have again. That were in person, but right now I'm basically at our place at the beach in Florida, Cocoa Beach. Big rocket just took off and made a lot of noise, so I'm glad it did it 5 minutes before I started your show. And I couldn't
that's
be doing this unless it were on Zoom. What?
I said that was a good way to start off the show.
Well, I thought, oh, my gosh, the place is shaking. I mean, is there an earthquake here? And then I realized lately there have been a lot of launches between SpaceX and I guess these recent Boeing flights and the NASA flights. So the area is kind of hopping from all this. For a while, it was very peaceful and quiet. But now, I don't know how long this is going to go on, but it seems to be pretty busy. Yes, I think you just have to keep doing it, and it's good to try to get a support system in place. And as I say, for me, at least for writing Walking with the Dead, my support system was the yearly Santa Barbara Writers Conference, which is held, well, it was held every summer, and hopefully by next summer it'll be back in place.
Fantastic. And Charles Docimos, we have thoroughly enjoyed and been informed with so much of your information, especially about Vietnam. I'm very excited about that. I hope more people in the media get excited about it because it is an important historical time in our history, and it needs to be told and needs to be for especially the younger people. It should be seen in schools, actually, and colleges, and people need to realize that they need to be involved in our government and make sure that, you know, we know why they're sending our children or grandchildren across the oceans to do battle, and not just because somebody, one person, decides that's what they're going to do. And
absolutely.
This is a matter of life and death. And so now's your time to shine. Now's your time to shine. Charles, you can give your website, contact information, and if you have a message for our guests, just blurt it out.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, and certainly if folks want to contact me, I'd be glad to try to answer their questions or help in any way I can. My information is on the two websites that I believe I've mentioned before, one being the film website, which is PompixWeb, P-O-M-P-I-X-W-E-B, PompixWeb.com. And the email for that is basically PompixAOL.com, PompixAOL. If you'd like to send me an email question, I'll be glad to answer it. And as far as the books, like Walking with the Dead, they are on the other website, which is www, and it's my name, author, namely Charles Domokos, CharlesDomokos, Charles Domokos, author.com. So thank you very much for having me on your show.
Wonderful. It was a pleasure, and we'll talk to you again maybe at the Book Publicist meetings.
Thank you very much. Really, really
You're
appreciate
welcome.
Having me on. Thank you.
You're
bye-bye,
so welcome,
Rose.
And thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And Charles Docimos has left the building, And I have a little bit of time to tell you about the Justice Club and our issue of the day. So don't touch that dial yet.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
And Colombo Chronicles Live has a little bit of information for you right here on the Defender. And on the Defender, it says Bill Gates, who, of course, has more money than not God, but almost, Indian government targeted in lawsuit alleging AstraZeneca vaccine killed 23-year-old. Well, I think there's a lot more cases of that accusation or allegation going around the world with other jabs as well that were deemed safe and effective. In what may be the first legal case of its kind globally, a petitioner in India is seeking to prosecute Bill Gates, Indian vaccine czar Adar Poonawalla, and Indian government and public health officials over the death of a 23-year-old man who died after receiving AstraZeneca's COVID-filled vaccine. Kiran Yadav late last year filed a criminal writ petition for murder. Smit Kiran Yadav versus the state of Maharashtra and Ors, herein referred to as Yadav versus Maharashtra, with the Bombay High Court of Judicature on behalf of her deceased son, Shri Hitesh Kadve, K-A-D-V-E. Her son was vaccinated on September 29, 2021. According to the complaint, he died that same day due to side effects brought on by the vaccine. The complaint alleges Kadve died due to an act of willful commission and omission attributable to some public servants who are misusing their position to bring policies to help the pharma mafia and thereby are responsible for mass murders. The complaint further states Yadav's son was unwillingly compelled. I will say in my blogs, I said that they are coercing, threatening, and fear-mongering in order to get people to comply by placing fear in their minds and placing them under duress, which is a crime and illegal in the United States of America to do so. In the past, the FDA original documents for the EUA, which is rarely used, if ever, in the United States, at least not to my knowledge, it hadn't been, and lockdowns are not quarantines. Quarantines are like 2 or 3 weeks. Not lockdowns where you're isolated in your home and told not to even go near your own baby or children or husband, or don't go to work, don't go to your business, don't go to school, even if you're healthy. And even if you're healthy, they said we had COVID. So it was a nightmare. So anyway, elder abuse and child abuse is not allowed in America because isolation of elders and children are child and elder abuse on the law books in America. And you can read my blogs at Rose for Justice, that's the number 4, roseforjustice.com. Coercion, fear-mongering, and threats are what criminals do in order to place fear in the minds of their victims so that they are so scared and confused and fear of punishment that they will comply with whatever they're told to do. That is not how government is to operate, nor the healthcare system, which is very unhealthy, in my opinion. I hope we can still give our opinions because freedom is not as free as it used to be, especially when it comes to freedom of speech, thoughts, questions, opinions, assembly. So the complaint further states Yadav's son was unwillingly compelled, and in USA we say coerced, to get vaccinated based on the false narrative that the vaccine was entirely safe and because the state of Maharashtra prohibited the non-vaccinated from riding on railroads or entering retail stores such as shopping malls. And in Canada and other countries, and even America, the hosts on television and social media suggested that they lock us out if we don't want, if we refuse to wear a mask into a grocery store or we aren't vaccinated. Seriously? When did fellow Americans become our law enforcers? Seriously? When did the entire population decide they have the authority to ask you if you've been vaccinated and to see your medical records? Because people have no authority to ask you those private, confidential questions, because that is between you and your doctor. And an injection, especially an experimental and trial injection, is not a licensed vaccine that takes 5 to 25 years to license. These are experimental and trial injections, and it's the privacy of an individual person to exercise their natural, free, God-given, unalienable right to free will and free choice to control their own bodies and minds, not your neighbor, not your family members, not your friends, just like you can't control theirs and shouldn't. They have a free will and a free choice given by God, not by government in the USA, because we, the people, are the government, and they are to do the will of the American people, but they are imposing their will on the American people. Anyway, this article goes on to say the complaint alleges Maharashtra's restrictions are against the central government's policy that there cannot be any discrimination between vaccinated and unvaccinated people. Other defendants in the case include the Commissioner and Director General of the Maharashtra State Police, the Indian Central Bureau of Investigation, and the Principal Secretary of the Indian Ministry of Health and Family Welfare. The complaint also brings charges against Bill Gates and Adar Poonawalla, CEO of the Serum Institute of India, the world's largest vaccine manufacturer by number of doses produced and sold. And why did HHS and Congress give 100% immunity in the United States to Pfizer, a multi-billion dollar business, who is the developer of the Pfizer trade secret formula and didn't disclose the trade secret formula and what mRNA is and what it does to the body and what they are actually injecting into millions of people's bodies? And what are the consequences? Was they did not inform the American people. They just said, like Bill Gates, you have no choice. Bill Gates is not a doctor, a scientist, a PhD, a virologist, and yet he's given the world stage as the expert on biochemical weapons and viruses and vaccines, and tells the American people we're his patients and we have no choice. How did this happen? Well, the Serum Institute produces the COVID Shield vaccine, as well as over half of the world's vaccines that are administered to babies. In all, Yadav is requesting 1,000 cores, 10 billion rupees of $134 million in the U.S. dollars in compensation, including 100 crores, or $13.4 million in U.S. dollars in interim compensation. She is seeking a lie detector and narcoanalyst test from Bill Gates, Poonawalla, and others. According to the complaint, the Indian government admitted the COVID Shield vaccine may have harmful and potentially fatal side effects, but the vaccine was administered despite the knowledge because Pfizer produced several pages, and the FDA also produced pages of potential serious adverse side effects to human beings, but did not include those that information prior to the rolling out of the injections, experimental and trial injections, when they started jabbing men, women, and children. And the FDA original documents, the EUA document said that only 16 years and older can participate in the EUA, but all experimental trial injections of drugs or treatments or jabs must be by willing volunteers with a sound mind who are informed of what the materials are that they are injecting into your body and require a signed consent. That isn't what's happening since they rolled out the jabs, the experimental and trial injections in January of 2021. And this is part of this complaint here. The complaint also stands out for the specific allegations made against figures such as Poonawalla and Bill Gates, a figure of extensive controversy in India. Now, this may open up an entire can of worms that may not end well for Big Pharma and for Bill Gates, because it could spread to America, to Australia, to Canada, and to Europe, where lawsuits start popping up because of the serious injuries and death tolls.
Well, my friends, time flies. And now is the time to say goodbye. Thanks so much for being part of the Colombo Chronicles family. You are appreciated. Please do it now. Bookmark. Push that like, share, and follow button. Oh, and don't forget to comment below and stay in touch. Make your family part of the Colombo family. Until next Wednesday at noon, remember, God loves you, and so does the Rose.